Hey, Christina.
Hey, Sam.
Tell it like it is.
Every Thursday morning from 10 to 11.
The Environment Report.
In-depth interviews, not sound bites.
Featuring local voices.
Covering the issues you need to know about.
In both counties and beyond.
Tune in to
Tell It Like It Is. On WGXC 90.7 FM. Hey, Christina.
Hey, Sam. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
That's good. Well, we've got full lineup. We've got your environment show.
Environment show coming up.
Yeah.
And then you have an interview after that.
Yeah, we've got Jean Giblet, who's coming into the studio to talk about herbs. And that should be fun. And then at 11, we're going to be having a special Valentine's Day show, you and
Inviting everyone to call in and tell us their stories of broken hearts and love gone awry.
Sounds like fun. Okay.
So, all right, here we go. Okay, this is Sam Sebring, and I have this week's environment report. With this wild, wonderful winter challenging us to think about our planet and Mother Nature on many levels, I'm just thinking that we should also remember there are others being hit hard by the relentless snow and ice as well. For example, our fine-feathered friends, the birds. This winter is particularly hard on them for issues of food, shelter, and water. Some theories... I'm trying to get some music going here at the same time. As I was saying, some theories question the effects of winter bird feeding, the thinking being that artificial feeding stations disrupt the migrating patterns of some birds. But actually, as more people have erected winter bird feeders since the early 80s, it has allowed several species to extend their ranges northward, including northern cardinals, tufted titmice, and red-bellied woodpeckers. Right now, in late winter, from February on, is the most difficult period for the birds. But winter bird feeding is a great responsibility, and if you want to enjoy the pleasures of it and seriously help the birds, you should consider the factors involved and do a little research. Some of the issues include what type of shelter is best to put out for the birds, what kind of feeders and where to place them in your yard that is safest from predators like cats or squirrels. You don't need to spend a lot of money on a feeder that looks like, say, a log cabin or some other novelty. Birds don't care if it's cute. And as long as you clean it out thoroughly, you could make something for free out of a household container or some scraps of wood. You also need to look into the best foods to feed the birds. There's a lot of information out there on the internet. You can Google Northeast Winter Bird Feeding or check out KingstonFieldNaturalists.org. They're in Canada, and I found their information very thorough and comprehensive with, they list other suggested readings and links. In other recent positive environmental news, it was reported on Reuters on Tuesday in an article titled City of Buffalo Bans Hydraulic Fracturing that the Buffalo City Council voted unanimously to prohibit natural gas extraction by the process known as fracking. The ordinance also bans storing, transferring, treating, or disposing fracking waste within the city. According to the drilling report, no such projects had been planned for Buffalo, though city officials were concerned that fracking wastewater from nearby operations was reaching the city's sewer system. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently enacted a similar ban. Perhaps more cities and towns will enact more bans on this controversial technique, as it has not been shown so far to be entirely safe. And speaking of safety, in a separate story, also from Reuters on Tuesday, explosions rocked Enterprise Products, a natural gas liquid storage complex in Mont Belvieu, Texas. Firefighters contained the massive fire, visible for 35 miles. The Mont Belvieu Enterprise Complex was built in 1979 and processes natural gas liquids like propane and butane for use at nearby petrochemical plants. The plant sits atop a salt dome where millions of cubic feet of natural gas liquids are stored and travel through a pipeline. Now, we're still cleaning up the Gulf oil spill, which happened only 10 months ago. So, I just question if we really need natural gas drilling all over the place, possibly creating more spills and explosions and other disasters. We've been talking about this as long as I've been alive, with nothing changing for the better, I'm sorry to say. And I just wonder how many of these explosions and disasters and spills will it take for us to get off of fossil fuels. But here's a song from 1974 called Vampire Blues, which unfortunately is still very relevant today.
I'll sell you 20 bells worth. Good times are coming.
That was Neil Young doing Vampire Blues from 1974. Talking way back then about how we're using up the resources of the earth. And along those lines, in cement news, in case anyone hasn't heard this, and just to remind you if you have heard about it. Representative John Carter in Texas is trying to get support for a congressional resolution to undo long overdue EPA regulations on harmful pollutants emitted by cement plants. The new EPA rules are slated to go into effect in 2013. If Representative Carter and cement companies from the Portland cement industry, which includes Lafarge, have their way, they will undo these rules before they've even begun. This could affect the plans for the Lafarge modernization project in Ravenna. Community Advocates for Safe Emissions, or CASE, and Friends of Hudson are working tirelessly to ensure that the Lafarge proposal is state-of-the-art and fully protective of human health. But they need your help. Go to case-ny.org and see details about their February fund drive. Also go to friendsofhudson.com for information about where you can write comments to the New York DEC and the New York Department of Health on the Lafarge issue. The deadline for the Department of Health comments is this Tuesday, February 15th. The deadline for the DEC comments is February 22nd. And last but not least, I just wanted to remind people to tune in to WGXC.org this Saturday night when we will be broadcasting live from Full Moon Resort in Big Indian. Music performances taking place at Snowflow, an event where activists, artists, and environmental organizations are coming together over shared concerns regarding environmental issues and the increasing frequency of global catastrophes. The public is welcome for outdoor activities during the day Saturday and or dinner and live music Saturday night. Reservations required. More info is at WGXC.org or snowflow.org or fullmooncentral.com. So, okay. Coming up next here on Tell It Like It Is, Christina.
Yes, I've got Gene Gablett, and I've got a little music, a little musical break first, and we'll be right back.
Perdí entre tu casa y mi casa, será el calor que no abraza, no es de gozo, no es de ira, como tampoco es mentira que algo de ti se ha escondido entre tu calle y mi alma. Será tal vez la esperanza de un cariño adormecido. Yo sabré reír, yo sabré llorar, yo sabré entregarte mi cariño.
Negra,
negra que te quiero,
cosa,
negra presuntuosa,
mira
que me estoy muriendo. Vida de tu boca,
bota,
que me está pisando los talones de la libertad.
That was a little Susana Baca, who is an Afro-Peruvian singer, and I'm very happy to have discovered her CD. Anyway, this is Christina, and we're here with the Tell It Like It Is crew, and our special guest today is Jean Giblet. And Jean, I'm very happy that you came in on this cold, sunny winter day.
Thank you, Christina.
And Jean is the proprietor of High Falls Garden. And we've actually talked, well, I don't know, Jean, I interviewed you on another station, what, about 5 or 6 years ago?
Yes, yes, up in Troy. Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can just introduce what High Falls Garden is to the listener audience and maybe update us afterwards on what you have been doing in the last interim period.
Sure, and feel free to ask questions, because I don't want to just make this a monologue.
Oh, no, I have tons of questions.
Oh, good. I've been farming, operating High Falls Gardens for over 15 years in Columbia County, and it's a very tiny medicinal plant farm. We've always had kind of a nonprofit mission, and we're nurtured by the Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation for 10 years, but mm-hmm. now we have an independent nonprofit called High Falls Foundation Incorporated. And our, unusual aspect is that we deal primarily with Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. So mm-hmm. I have over 100 species of Asian medicinal plants growing there, most of them perennials, including trees and shrubs. And this is the most interesting subject I've ever encountered in my life. It's totally fascinating to me. It's something that I never imagined I could be doing. But yet, the more I learn, the more I realize that we're really on the threshold of something that can revolutionize not only healthcare, but the economy as well. Mm-hmm. And I see that this has many applications for the local economy here in Columbia and Greene counties, and New York and the Northeast particularly.
So you're talking about folks growing. Well, can you expand on that? How would that?
It's been known by botanists since the 17th century that the plants of Eastern North America and Eastern Asia are very similar. And they attribute this to the fact that once upon a time, back in geological prehistory, they were all the same plants, but then patterns of glaciation caused them to diverge. Mm-hmm. And now there are at least two species in many genera of plants. The most famous example is the ginsengs. So we have North American ginseng and Asian ginseng.
Right.
And it's not clear that you would be able to tell them apart if you didn't know much about ginseng and they were growing right next to each other. But the Chinese discovered North American ginseng through the Jesuit missionaries.
Amazing.
300 years ago, and they imported it. They decided it was different from their own ginseng. Mm-hmm. It had a different action, but they wanted ours too. So all those boats that were bringing crockery, blue and white crockery, over from China into New England were going back full of ginseng.
Amazing.
It was harvested by essentially Indians and poor whites, and sold into what was then a global trade. So this is ginseng is only one example of how the Chinese were alert to value that we don't know about, and we meaning basically European and African Americans, because we came to this continent and disrupted the red man's culture. And, of course, they knew all about these plants.
I was going to ask that next. Was there a similar kind of medicinal system amongst the Native
yes.
Americans as the Chinese?
Yes.
Amazing.
And, the difference there is that the Chinese wrote everything down. The Chinese were literate 2,000 and more years ago. Their oldest medical texts go back well over 2,000 years. Archaeological finds are kind of pushing the date back mm-hmm. of the earliest texts. And the amazing thing is that the Divine Farmer's Materia Medica, the Shenong Bansao, means Divine Farmer's Materia Medica, it was written for healthy people. And it told people how to use herbs, dividing them into superior grade herbs that everyone can eat like food, middle grade herbs that you really shouldn't take very often, and then inferior grade, which you really need a practitioner to help you with. Hmm. So it was written for healthy people as a means to stay healthy.
Right.
And then the really mind-boggling feature of traditional Chinese medicine is that whereas in North America, what we learned from the Indians, what the Europeans and Africans learned from the Indians was codified in a Materia Medica, and the naturopaths created a book in the 1950s that had maybe 300 species of medicinal plants. But the current Materia Medica of the People's Republic of China has over 7,800 species of plants. Mm-hmm. That's almost a quarter of their known plants in Asia mm-hmm. were classified medicinally. So the scope of what they knew and recorded about plants is absolutely mind-boggling. And what that does effectively is open up the possibility of at least 150 new specialty crops for us here in the Northeast. And the other thing is that the reason that this is important is that the traditional way to take these herbs is to make time-tested combinations and to boil it and strain it and drink the soup. That's called a decoction. And it tastes really bitter. But it's considered that the bitter flavor prepares the body for change. Mm-hmm. So the art of formulation is actually one of the most significant aspects of it. And I think we can just assume that the Indians knew how to do this. It's just that they didn't write it down for us.
Right.
So I think that the implications here are that we get off the drug model. Mm-hmm. We cease thinking of medicine as a chemical that's extracted from plants. And we shift over to thinking of medicine as more like food, that it's a combination of whole plant parts mm-hmm. in their whole form. And one hopes grown in a highly diverse, biologically active ecological setting so that the potency of the plant is maximized.
Right. You've brought up so many issues just now. I want to go right to when you talked about the land. Are you talking about having a biodynamic base for
yes.
growing these plants?
Yes.
And could you explain what that means?
Well, people who took biology in school more than 15 years ago are out of touch. And unfortunately, our corporate media have actively held in place old ideas about biology and agriculture and medicine, so that people are confused about this issue. But the fact is that very recently, within the last 15 years, there's been this revolution in biology in several ways. One is discovering that there are just literally billions of species of microbes in the soil, air, water, and that they're arrayed in they're aggregated in ways that are beneficial to the plant, so that the plant is not just a vegetable sitting there passively in the soil. It's actively managing its microbial substrate. It's in essence doing its own farming by putting out chemicals and attracting these microbes. So the implications of those findings, that most of the microbes on the planet are actually not only benign, but actually protective of the plant and of us. And, of course, we have an equivalent situation in our guts.
Right.
So this is how we assimilate food, and the same way the plant does, by depending on the byproducts of the microbes. So this, once a person understands this, then we realize how bad it is to put artificial chemicals,
right,
not only in the soil, but in our bodies. And manufactured drugs, industrial medicine, is far too extreme to really maintain health. It destabilizes the body, and that's why you get symptoms, they're called side effects, but they're actually the effects of the drug. So then often you're prescribed yet another drug, and especially older people may be taking 20 drugs a day.
Right, right.
This is because the medicine itself is not something that we should be ingesting.
I want to go back to what you were talking about. This, it's almost like a microbial ecosystem.
Yes.
I think that also addresses the way that we approach the land, that industrial farming and farming in general can be very disruptive of how the land is already organized.
Yes.
And so to go in there and plow or to tear up land and then plant it and then add a lot of extra nutrients to it, which are usually petroleum-based, seems to be an incredibly artificial and disruptive
yes.
way of... So can you tell us a little bit about how you grow herbs in your... Is it a one-acre...
Yes, I have about 1 acre in a permaculture setup. Most of my plants are perennials, and permaculture means permanent agriculture. It's about farming with perennial plants. And you try to set up a food forest is one of the common terms used now. It's a setting where you have a lot of different plants growing in close proximity, and many of them are harvestable, either the fruit, the bark, the leaves. You can coppice a tree. I have coppiced white and mulberry trees in my field so that we can strip the leaves off and sell the leaves in dried form. There are just literally hundreds of potential products. And it's a different kind of agriculture, but it's much more similar to the way the Indians used to farm. And that's another fairly recent revelation from late 20th century New World archaeology, that the Indians were actually farming. It's just that the Europeans were too blind to recognize it. They didn't see it as a farm. They didn't see these highly managed woodland settings as agriculture, and yet it was. And then when the Indians died from the white man's diseases, the land went quickly out of management and became overgrown. So that fed into the idea that it was a wilderness here, when actually there's now plenty of evidence that it wasn't. It was a highly managed setting. And that's what we need to go back to.
Amazing. I mean, because what you're saying right now, thinking about what Sam was talking about in his environment report about feeding the birds and being in connection with ecosystems that exist, that that connection, I think, is disrupted when we start thinking about the land as something to exploit for profit.
Yes.
We're not living with the land. We're exploiting it to get something from it.
Right. But it's an industrial idea of profit. Mm. And there is another idea of profit, and that is about banking value back into the land. It's not strictly restoration. It's more remediation or mitigation. But it involves planting a lot more species than exist here now, and in a more denser, more highly diverse, and then using techniques such as the addition of mycorrhizal fungi, mm-hmm. which are necessary for the forest floor and the health of the ecosystem. There are many, many techniques now that are being rediscovered and applied so that we build up the health of the setting, and that builds our health. So the new idea of health is that we don't exist in isolation from the land. We're completely tied to it.
Right.
And in order to build our health, we bank health in the landscape.
I was just going to add that it's, you know, it's sort of along the idea, as you're saying about the microbes, that that's all connected. And also the idea that, you know, because we've been talking a lot about water and pure water lately on mm-hmm. the show, and how all water is ultimately connected, and that's part of the land as well.
Right. And that artificial oil-based fertilizer mm-hmm. runoff is in all the waterways of the United States. All the pharmaceutical drugs we're peeing out are passing through
right.
our bodies.
Estrogens.
Every artificial sweetener passes through our bodies, plus all the chemicals that Rachel Carson was complaining about 40 years ago
DDT.
Are still here. So we've got this chemical soup built mm-hmm. up in the water.
Jean, I'm just on a very personal level. Do you think, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but do you think that has increased health issues? I'm curious about cancer because, I mean, it's just...
Absolutely. How could it not be? If we're building up this toxic brew and can't get away from it, then we're... Cancer is a response of the body, and I'm not a clinician, I have to say. I'm not a clinical herbalist. I guess you could call me a research herbalist.
Okay.
But I don't treat patients. However, I have studied with the clinicians extensively in order to learn their language. Cancer is a response to some kind of irritant combined with a lack of nutrition, so that there's not enough protective nutrition to overcome the effect of the irritation. That's the way I see it. And the lack of protection comes from the artificial food. So I'm 62 years old. I was born in 1948. The first cake mix was sold in 1946. The whole idea of
right.
fake food is... within my lifetime.
Right.
And that completely blows my mind because it's about how quickly people lose knowledge in our culture. It takes just two generations for people to literally forget how to eat and what food tastes like. That's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, in relating to bringing up the cancer topic and this... the food, and it just seems like I'm noticing more and more now people that I know who have cancer.
Yeah.
And compared to, like, let's say in the 70s, I might know of like one or two people a year.
Yeah.
Now I'm hearing of like a friend or a friend of a friend almost every week.
Yes. And that's it's undoubtedly through the toxic buildup. Well, how are you going to prove, quote unquote, scientifically that that's true when our science really doesn't deal with cumulative effects very well? We don't have a means to fund the studies that show
right.
the effect of this increase, this buildup.
Yeah, I mean, we have lots of material source data sheets on all kinds of just even my in the time that I've lived in Hudson in the last 20 years, there's been styrene in the air from a button factory, and there's PCBs at a brownfield down by Foster Refrigerator.
Right.
And apparently they can go airborne from the water itself. And I mean, I can go on and on, but I think what I'd like to know is, you're talking about, I think, something, an even richer and deeper issue, which is this disconnect from nature.
Yes.
And then you're pairing that also with, you've mentioned how you can actually create a living, a profitable living, without destroying our natural base.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that, and also kind of how you evolved into, because you said you never thought in a million years that you would be doing this. How did that happen?
Well, I'll answer that one first. But I grew up in central Minnesota in a pre-industrial setting. We weren't actually on a farm. My dad's parents had a farm that they had sold by the time I was born. So I really come out of a farming culture. And yet I thought that I had left that when I went off to college. And I discovered that I hadn't. It was in my blood. So that's really how I was drawn to this. And I thought of a health career after college, and actually worked in community mental health during the 70s as an administrator. But somehow the industrial medicine put me off in a way. And I just couldn't see how to fit in. And in the early 90s, when I discovered traditional Chinese medicine, it made complete sense to me from the very beginning. The economic value that I see is the fact that we're changing our minds so that medicine is now not a manufactured product, it's an agricultural product. And not only that, but it's a combination of literally hundreds of agricultural products. So to take cancer as an example, traditional Chinese medicine sees that there are literally hundreds of plants that treat cancer. They don't speak of a cure for cancer. They talk about treating it, which is reducing the size of the tumors, reducing the irritation that is provoking the cells to respond in a certain way. So there are literally hundreds of these plants that can be effective in treating cancer. And, of course, every person has to make his or her own decision once diagnosed with cancer. But I like to think that if I were, I would immediately go to the nearest traditional Chinese herbalist and start drinking decoctions. Hmm. And only after a few weeks would I allow my body to be irradiated and chemotherapy, because I realized that that really affects the liver system, which is the body's means of detoxification. Mm-hmm. And if you're taking an herbal approach, then you want the body to be functioning to detoxify you and to flush the system. I know personally people who have gone herbal with cancer and are still around after 10 years.
Huh.
So without Western medical treatment. But that's a very personal decision, and I don't think, you know, I wouldn't give anyone advice on that score.
Well, Jean, I can't believe how the time's flying, but I would like you to speak about more about how your nonprofit, what that's set up to do, or is it teaching? Is it educational based? Because it sounds like this is the education. This is part of the new environmentalism and that we need to learn. And you've hit on so many subjects. I'm just kind of like my head is spinning.
Most people don't realize that traditional Chinese medicine snuck in under the radar, just like organic farming did in the 70s and 80s. And now they have a national establishment. They have over 50 graduate colleges that are private. They have national certification, licensure by the states, more than 42 or 43 states, and including New York, license these people. And it's estimated that there are 23,000 licensed practitioners now. So it's been the fastest growing healthcare modality. Well, also, I have been working with scientists at land-grant universities. My primary mentor in that regard is Dr. Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst. So the scientists, there are groups of scientists now that have become very interested in studying these plants. And so the fascinating thing, and I do my nonprofit work on a national level, so I work with groups of Oriental medicine practitioners, farmers, and scientists, three different networks mm-hmm. that I'm tapped into. And I recently got the Council of Colleges of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine to strongly back a proposal going to the USDA from the scientists who want to study the herbs. And when that type of research is funded, it's going to open a whole door to a new line of investigation. It's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And at that point, farmers who want to get into it will find more means of support. And so I think it's coming within the next 5 years.
So here we are looking at Columbia and Greene counties. We've been in the United States is in the largest recession or depression. They don't want to use that word.
Yes.
In the last, 70, 80 years. And in fact, I mentioned to people from New York City many times that I don't think upstate New York has ever really really experienced anything but a really depressed economy. And we are an agricultural area. You see articles all the time about farmers, dairy farmers, giving up their land. Land is getting developed for, big box stores. Land that's actually very valuable mm-hmm. when we look at it from your perspective. Mm-hmm. What could people who are thinking about hydrofracking now as being an opportunity to take what little land they have or take the land they have and make, money off of it? You're proposing something that could answer that in part.
Well, it's not a quick and easy answer.
No.
And everybody wants that right now. But I think one of our problems right now is misunderstanding of what money is. Mm-hmm. We think it comes from these international banksters that are, have hijacked it. And we're angry that the banks aren't even lending to successful Main Street businesses right now. Right. But in fact, anytime there's an exchange of value among us here in the county, there's the potential for money, because money is just a recording system. It's just information about an exchange of value. So if we have a value chain set up with our landowners and farmers growing these valuable herbs, other people harvesting them, processing them, practitioners dispensing them, and patients being employed at all these levels of added value, mm-hmm. then you have a complete value chain for health. Yeah. Health preservation, health maintenance, preventive health. And anytime you have a complete value chain right here in Columbia and Greene counties, you have the potential for a business credit system or some other way to monetize it. I'm not saying it's a complete solution,
right.
But if we have all the elements to produce these things here, then that's an opportunity. And I'm reading the theorists who are coming up with alternative monetary systems and business credit systems. And I find this absolutely fascinating, because it's all what people decide. We just have to have enough people who want to go in this direction, and it will happen.
Right.
Yeah. But, I love this idea.
This is Joan.
Yes, this is Joan. I love this idea, and I think that's where we should go. My problem is the obstacles, the pharmaceutical industries. There's big money here, and they've already conditioned people to believe that that's what's going to save them.
Right.
So, and then with all of the cuts that they have so much power, they'd rather research money go in where they can get into the door rather than the government give research money for something that's true, that's wise. And
yes.
And that's what's real worry.
That's all true. The old order right now is hanging on to every nickel to do things the same old way. So what has to happen? And social change never happens with a mass of people. There's always some little group that does a demonstration somewhere that works.
Like you were saying, it's just up to people to change their minds and make a different decision.
Right.
And there are, you know, I'm reading more and more about little communities where they're developing their own currencies.
Yes.
Are you hearing about that?
Yes. That was pioneered in Ithaca, New
right.
York.
Ithaca.
The Schumacher Society over in
right.
Great Barrington, which is now renamed, kind of carrying the torch for that. But that's all. Remember, money is just an information system,
mm-hmm.
and what you really have to pay attention to is where the real value is.
Mm.
You have to make sure that there's real value. We in Philmont, we tried a little alternative currency system in the mid-90s, and it failed because all the currency got bollocksed. It got blocked up at the dentist and the car mechanic. The car mechanic had a lot of young children, and he couldn't buy food with the currency. And I don't know what the dentist was doing, but it failed because we had no really basic needs met
uh-huh.
by the units participating in that. So it failed. The one in Ithaca has succeeded because it started out with food. It started out with the farmers and farmers markets.
Right.
So it's lasted for 25 years or whatever it is.
That's really interesting.
It's almost borders on, as you're talking about how a lot of this health history and farming goes way back thousands of years with the
mm-hmm.
Chinese.
Yes.
It almost, what we're now talking about these money systems, almost goes back to some sort of barter system possibly being.
The old country doctor who gets a chicken in exchange for giving somebody a checkup. I know acupuncturists right now in rural areas who are taking chickens. That's a straight barter system. But you can elaborate on that. And there are theorists like Thomas Greco Jr., who's based in Tucson, Arizona, who points out that now that we have computers, you can set up a whole credit system among a group of people, and you don't actually need physical currency. It's a matter of trust, but that's what life is anyway.
We have very little trust these days.
Well, we don't have trust for banksters and politicians, but maybe we could use some among ourselves here.
I'd like to, because we're in the last couple of minutes of our program, which is almost unbelievable, but everything is just so fascinating. To go back to the herbs and the use of the land, if one was interested in creating a farm, is there a school that they would attend, a university similar to the Cornell or something?
Unfortunately, that's something that we've struggled to put in place. There aren't too many training programs available right now, and I am sorry to not have something more substantial to offer, but there are a couple things that if any listener wants to contact me, email me at hfg@capital.net. That's HFG for High Falls Gardens at Capital, CAPITAL.net. And I will try to give you some suggestions to get started, but ordinarily people who want to get into it will grow out a bunch of different things and try to focus on what they like and what way you want to go. Trees, shrubs, barks, roots, leaves, you know, there are a whole different variety of things that you could adapt to a given operation.
How much land are we talking about, Jean?
A householder with a quarter acre could plant a couple of trees and in 15 years be getting a nice crop off of that.
Would this have applications for urban farming also?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are some really beautiful medicinal plant farms, Camp Hill Copaic, right here in our own county, for instance, that it's, 2 acres max.
Can people come and visit your
We're having a community field day on June 19th this year, which is Sunday, Father's Day, in the afternoon. That's really about it, because I bring classes of Oriental medicine practitioners in for training programs. I'm just starting to work with some farmers here to see if we can get more plants in the ground. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get volunteers to help also. So you may be hearing more about it. There's a ginseng movie that we want to show that might be coming up, and I'll let you know so you can advertise that.
Yeah, you'll let us know. We'll tell everybody.
Good.
Yeah. What about the danger of wild harvesting? You mentioned ginseng, and I think American ginseng. I mean, the other side of this enthusiasm for maybe an alternate economy and an alternate way of growing food. Is that a problem? I think
yes. That's a whole. Series of shows right there.
Okay.
The whole ginseng world. Ginseng is a controlled, because it's on the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, CITES. So it is heavily regulated. But beyond that, people should not be going onto other people's lands and taking plants. That's stealing.
Right.
That's called stealing.
So you're talking about like state land?
Yeah. Land that doesn't belong to them, actually. But any public land, it's a problem, because someone goes on and takes black cohosh, for instance. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know who's been there before and who's coming after. And it's degrading the stock of black cohosh in the landscape. So the solution to that is for landowners and growers to establish and protect things like black cohosh. And then, harvesters could move around, itinerant harvesters could move around and provide the labor to do the harvest in a controlled way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that is a problem, but it's also a complex subject. And I'm dismayed that the public doesn't know more about ginseng. So I'd like to try to address that in some way. Maybe if we can...
We can certainly have you back and have you talk about it maybe before the June 19th field day.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I can't believe we literally have 4 minutes left. So in that last 4 minutes, I don't know, in wrapping up, if what you want to leave the listeners with. You've given us plenty to think about, but land disruption, species diversity, new ways of farming that don't disrupt the soil or the ecology of the soil.
Well, I haven't offered anyone any quick fixes, but anyone can start to use more herbs in their diet. Culinary herbs have medicinal effects. So if you throw some dried rosemary from the healing plant in Copaic, which you can buy at the healing plant or the Hawthorne Valley Farm Store, that's biodynamically grown herb. That's a primo product. Throw that on your eggs in the morning. You know, the way you eat and incorporating as many different things as possible is one of the best things you can do for your health
right now.
I keep a rosemary plant in my window in winter, and that's really easy to do. You can have some herbs in some little pots in a windowsill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know who to hit next.
Yes.
The rosemary.
Yeah, and it really enhances the quality of life. So that's where you can start.
Are there any books that you recommend? Because I almost envision people maybe haphazardly using herbs also. But there's plenty of wild herbs. There's or plants, I would say, like nettles.
Yes.
And what?
Oh well, there are a lot of herb books out there, and the plants like nettles that are okay to make tea out of. those are pretty well addressed. I think Susan Weed across the river has several books, and those are available for someone who wants to get more in depth. As for growing Chinese medicinal herbs, my colleague out in California, Peggy Schaefer, is coming out with a book this year published by Chelsea Green on growing Chinese medicinal herbs. So we'll have a little bit more on that subject.
Okay. And, well, I can't believe it's almost 11, Jean. I want to thank you so much for coming in. And, again, if people want to know more about High Falls Garden, they can go to hfg@capital.net. And we've been speaking to Jean Giblet of High Falls Garden. And thanks so much, Jean.
Thank you, Christina. This is really fun.
Okay.
It's been a delight.
I feel like we just touched the subject, so we'll definitely have you back.
Okay, good.
Okay. Thanks
a lot.
My
pleasure.
All right. And thanks, Sam. And thank you, Morning Crew, Joan and Alan. And we'll go out with a little music to take us out about the farm.
Sell my car.